It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Democrats in Congress are moving forward with a plan aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. We'll talk with a healthcare policy expert about what it would do and if it would mean real savings for you. First, journalism has had a mission of holding people in power accountable for a long time in the U.S. But one group of researchers thought that the way politics has changed in the last few decades warranted some new approaches by newsrooms. In particular, they point out that democracies shifting to authoritarian rule used to happen abruptly and clearly, not so much anymore. So they're out with a new resource for journalists about covering threats to democracy, and we're taking a look at that right now. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the job news media has been doing when it comes to covering politics? When does it feel biased to you, and when is it just correcting false statements? What do you want to see in political news coverage that you're not seeing right now? More context, information, different perspectives? And have you changed where you get your news for one reason or another? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Dresden is a policy advocate at the nonpartisan, nonprofit organization Protect Democracy. She previously served on the faculty and was associate director of the Democracy and Governance Program at Georgetown University. The new resource from Protect Democracy is called The Authoritarian Playbook, a Media Guide. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the motivation behind creating this resource for journalists right now?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you said in the introduction, we typically think of the breakdown of democracy as coming in sort of a big headline grabbing event, you know, a military coup or something where it's very clear that democracy has declined and there is now an authoritarian system in place. But that's really sort of a dated model. That's not how it works around the world anymore. And instead, what we see is that authoritarianism happens step by step with a drip, drip, drip of small changes that in the aggregate, when you take a step back, you sort of wake up one day and say, oh my gosh, you know, what happened to our democracy? And for journalists, that's actually a really challenging process to cover. And one of the things we were getting questions from reporters and from journalists that basically said, you know, look, a lot of this stuff, it looks like normal political jockeying in a lot of ways. You know, politics is competitive. It's supposed to be in a democracy. And when people are competing, they're trying their best to get advantage, you know, within the system. But the things that are real threats to democracy are different in important ways. And so the motivation here was really just to provide a resource for journalists that was going to aggregate and summarize what the, you know, the experts say on this, the people who have spent their lives studying these processes around the world, to sort of distill it down into a resource that journalists could use to have a standard against which to measure these events in the world. So that's the motivation. That's where it came from.
Yeah. And in this media guide, you lay out the idea that journalists should be unbiased, but not necessarily neutral. Can you talk about what that means?
Absolutely. So being unbiased means not bringing personal filters or personal ideology to frame or shape the information that's being reported. And I think that that's something that's vital about the news media and how people get their information. But being unbiased does not mean refusing to draw any conclusions about what that information means, right? So being unbiased would have you present, you know, reliable, verifiable facts as they happen. But that doesn't mean that I have to say that this animal in front of me has four legs, is amphibious, moves by hopping, but that I can't call it a frog, right? Because there's a difference between a frog and a salamander. And if I refuse to say, well, this is a frog and that's a salamander, that's not being unbiased necessarily. You can call it a frog and be unbiased because according to the objective set standard that we have, this is a frog and that is a salamander.
And we're living in a time now where I think a lot of us have maybe had some frustration about supposed facts, supposed reality being debated in the political sphere and becoming a political issue, whether that be election results, whether that be public health measures. Were those some of the concerns you were hearing from journalists who were asking you about this?
I think they certainly fall into the categories. I think those are areas that are clearly of concern. But there is also a question here that we hear from journalists, not just about, facts versus falsity, right? But also concerns about how to understand what is happening. And that, I think, is really the core of this report, is to offer a resource, even if you have, facts that we all agree are the facts, how do we understand what they mean?
Sure. And then from reading your report, it sounds like context is really important, both historical and looking around the world at what's happening with authoritarian governments.
Context is absolutely vital. I think because this process is such a piecemeal, step-by-step process, context really is crucial to understanding how concerned we ought to be. And I think one of the things that journalists do, and is absolutely a vital part of the role that they play in a democracy, is to provide that context to the general public.
We're talking with Jennifer Dresden right now with the nonprofit organization Protect Democracy about their new resource for journalists called the Authoritarian Playbook, a Media Guide, about how to better cover threats to democracy. And Jen, in that guide, you lay out seven different ways that authoritarian governments can take hold in that slow drip style that you mentioned. I want to talk about a couple of those. One is politicization of independent institutions. This is something that might seem dry in a news story, maybe a little bit boring. You say these independent institutions are key when it comes to democracies and authoritarian governments. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we're seeing this happening, or have seen this over the last number of years, happening across a number of different areas. And one of the examples where I would look at, where, as you say, it might seem dry, but it's really vital, is things like election administration, right? We depend on elections to be run in an independent, nonpartisan, impartial way, right? That is absolutely essential to how any democracy functions. But Protect Democracy worked with partners at States United Democracy Center and Wisconsin's own Law Forward to track all of the bills being introduced around the country in state legislatures that would politicize or criminalize or interfere with election administration. And in the first part of this year, we found that there were over 200 bills being introduced around the country that would degrade the independence and the capacity of election administrations around the country. And this should be particularly concerning to your listeners, because what we found is that in the first part of this year, Wisconsin actually led the country in the number of bills of this type that were under consideration.
And so what advice would you have for journalists, say, in Wisconsin or another state, covering perhaps a local development on that topic and kind of putting it in context of a potential threat to a healthy democracy?
Absolutely. So I think for journalists that are covering these issues, there are four steps that we would recommend. The first is to look at a particular event or development. And in the context of those sort of seven issue areas that you mentioned that we lay out in the report, first ask the question, does this action or this event, does it fit within any of these seven areas? And if it does, to then move on to three other really vital questions that we think should inform how these things are covered. So first, is this thing that's happening in the context of other actions in the playbook? And if so, to what degree is it happening? Is this an isolated one-off event? Is it something that is a really intense example of whatever it is that's happening, whether it be the number of bills that are being introduced or other issue areas? Is it happening over and over? So how much is this happening and what is the context? And then the next question to ask is, how much does this deviate from precedent, right? Our democracy is not perfect, certainly. There are aspects of our democracy that have always needed improvement. But knowing whether this is something new and dangerous requires understanding what that historical context means. And then the fourth question to ask, and I think that this is really vital, is to look at whether this action presents a systemic risk to democracy. And what I mean by that is not just to look at whether there's sort of one bad actor or one loose cannon doing something that's problematic, but rather to look at the way that others in our political space are responding. Because if we see that institutions are facilitating or accelerating the problematic behavior, if we see that political parties are not constraining their members or things like that, that goes from one bad apple to a broader problem of our system. And that's when we really ought to be getting concerned, because that means that the sort of self-correction aspects of our system that we have, the checks and balances, that those are not functioning right. And that's when we really ought to be concerned.
I want to go to the phones now. We have Joseph with us in Green Bay. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. So originally I was just calling to say, I think you had some question about whether or not you've changed news sources and what kind of news sources you use. I'm a pretty public news person, NPR, WPRAM in Wisconsin, and then PBS, WPBS. But also I try to look just at general, every once in a while I'll Google, you know, as far as like news bias and look at the major, you know, typically I find like Politico and The Hill are kind of one center right, one center left, and I try to read things from there so that I get kind of a rounded way that people are spinning a certain issue one way or the other. Although since then, the conversation you guys have been having is pretty interesting. I feel like it's been a good 30, 40 years since some of those bad apples have started kind of infecting the rest of the apples in American democracy. And, you know, I think right now we're ranked like number 26th or 27th in the world as far as functioning democracies. This falsehood that we are the best country in the world and anywhere else your vote is nil. And it's been a long time since that's been the truth.
Joseph, thanks for the call. Jennifer, what do you think of what Joseph had to say about putting together a media diet and how the media as a whole is doing on covering this stuff?
Yeah, well, I think that looking at a range of credible sources is always a great idea. I think that more information for voters when they're looking, again, at credible sources is a great choice. Overall with this, you know, I think what we're seeing is that a lot of journalists are doing a really, just really tremendous work in covering these issues and in covering these challenges. I think that there's been a real acceleration in the rate at which reporters and editors are being very deliberate in how they think about these issues and how they think about some of the things we write about in the report. And so the report is not intended to suggest that there isn't good work being done here or that there isn't good coverage out there. There really is. But one of the things that I think is worth flagging is that for reporters, this is really challenging. Right? And they're working under very real constraints of deadlines and word counts, and you know, there's only so much they can do. And so the report is really intended to be a resource for them to help just make it a little bit easier for them to do the work that, you know, they really want to do well.
We're talking with Jennifer Dresden right now, policy advocate for the nonprofit Protect Democracy, looking at how journalists can be unbiased but not necessarily neutral in their work covering politics and a healthy democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in your political coverage that you're not getting right now? Do you think journalists are not being neutral enough, or are they being too neutral? Do you want to see a little more teeth, a little more information, context in your news reporting? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Jennifer Dresden from the nonprofit group Protect Democracy about their new guide for journalists, an authoritarian playbook, a media guide. And Jennifer, we were talking about some of the aspects of authoritarianism that you lay out in that guide. They include things like quashing of dissent, corrupting of elections, stoking of violence, another, aggrandizing executive power. And with that last one in mind, I want to listen to a clip from 2019 of former President Donald Trump talking outside the White House about his use of acting cabinet members. Here's a listen.
Well, I'm in no hurry. I have acting, and my actings are doing really great. David is doing great at Interior. Mick Mulvaney is doing great as chief of staff. But I sort of like acting. Gives me more flexibility. Do you understand that? I like acting. So we have a few that are acting. We have a great, great cabinet.
That's former President Trump there with plenty of Marine One in the background talking about acting secretaries versus confirmed ones. What are you hearing in that clip, Jennifer?
So this is an example of where something that has a place and has a role in our democracy gets turned into something that is really problematic. Right. We have laws that provide for a limited space for acting secretaries, acting appointees, as stopgaps when there is some reason that the constitutional requirement that the Senate advise and consent on these appointments be fulfilled, right? The Senate's not in session or there's some other situation, but it's a very limited space. And this is where context and precedent that I talked about before really matters. By September of 2020 alone, just that window in former President Trump's administration, there were 15 appointed officials who were in direct violation of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, who are holding their positions contrary to some very clear law on this. And what that does is it denies one part of government, the Senate, its ability to hold another part of government, the executive, accountable for things like the people who are put in place. And those procedures are there to ensure that those checks and balances are there and that the president, for example, is not appointing officials who are loyal only to him or who are unqualified for their positions or who are likely to take actions that are contrary to the needs of our democracy. And so this is an example really that is quite clear, right? President Trump said in that quote, he liked the flexibility that appointed officials give him. Well, democracy is a system where no one person is supposed to have absolute flexibility. There are checks and balances. They are there for accountability. They're there for a reason. That's one of the fundamental principles of democracy.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Peter with us in Ashland. Hi, Peter.
Hello. There's a book that covers some of this stuff about that's related to Nazi Germany. But the interesting thing is it's a Milwaukee woman who at UW met a German, married him, moved to Germany in 1928, and they were opposed to the Nazis taking over and did everything they could. But that book really covers how Hitler very legally took over the government. And there's so many, as you're reading it, there's so many parallels to right now, it's scary.
Gotcha. Peter, thanks for the call. Peter, I think maybe referring to Mildred Harnack there. Jennifer, obviously, 1930s Germany, a comparison we always have to be careful with. But you also point out more recent, current examples of countries taking the slide into authoritarianism that you think journalists can keep in mind.
Absolutely. You know, we definitely always want to be careful about the comparisons that we draw. Again, one of our big points in the playbook is that context is vital. But I do think that there are a number of countries around the world that we can point to. You know, look, the United States is not unique in the challenges that we are facing. For the last 15 years, democracy around the world has been in recession, essentially. Countries all over the world have been facing these challenges. And I think that for any particular instance of what we see in the United States, there are parallels overseas. So if you look at some of the expansion of executive power and the sort of dismantling of checks and balances that you see in a place like Hungary, for example, that would be one area where we see similar dynamics at play. But you know, what we do in the report is for each element of the playbook, we look both to examples of what we see in the United States, but also elsewhere around the world. And it's not limited to one geographic region or one area. We can see parallels in Hungary, as I said, or in India, or in the Philippines. This is really a global problem that we are seeing our own American version of at home.
I think a lot of newsrooms over the past number of years have probably seen the polls showing public opinion in the press is going down. A lot of people think media is too biased. And so sometimes pointing out, stances or positions by politicians as a threat to democracy might be a little scary. What would you say to an editor, a newsroom who is worried about potentially scaring off readers by taking a little bit more of a stronger stance?
Right. So this is an area where I think what we try to do in the playbook is offer some concrete tips to journalists and to editors about how to cover these things in ways that are concrete, that are rooted in the facts, that again, leave very little room for the introduction of bias there. So when we talk about, for example, we talked about politicizing independent institutions, right? There are ways of covering these issues that rely on experts who really can explain the history of a particular institution, or experts in election administration who can explain why it's so important that election administrators be independent, or why it's so important that law enforcement be independent of partisan politics. And so what we try to do in the report is offer concrete tips for journalists and editors to do this in a way that is grounded and that sort of, again, leaves very little room for individual bias, but makes choices about how stories are covered. That, again, calls a frog a frog.
Well, Jennifer, that's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Drusden is a policy advocate at the nonprofit group Protect Democracy. We talked with her today about the guide her group put together to help journalists identify and report on threats to democracy. More to come here on Central Time. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of the pioneering researchers on forgiveness joins us to share the personal and communal benefits of forgiveness and how we can do it better. Now, Democrats in Congress are moving forward with a plan aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. One key provision would empower Medicare to negotiate the price of certain drugs. Another would make drug makers pay rebates if they raise the cost of a prescription faster than inflation. We're taking a closer look at the proposals, what it would mean for the cost you pay for medicine, and fact-checking some of what the pharma lobby is saying about the plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Medicare should be allowed to negotiate prescription drug costs? Is it something you've been waiting on Congress to do? How do prescription drugs affect your budget, your health? If you've lived in another country and needed prescription drugs, what was that experience like? What was the cost like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. John Abramson is a lecturer of healthcare policy at the Harvard Medical School and author of the book Sickening: How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. He served as an unpaid consultant to the Department of Justice and FBI on a pharmaceutical case that led to the largest criminal fine in U.S. history. And he was a practicing family physician for over 20 years. Dr. Abramson, thanks for joining us today.
Dean, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this plan by Democrats has undergone some changes over the last few months. But could you talk about, as it stands right now, how would it go about lowering prescription drug costs?
It will lower prescription drug costs on some prescriptions, and we need to talk about what it does and what it doesn't do. So the basic structure of the bill is that it will allow negotiation, price negotiation, on 10 drugs initially, going up to 20 drugs over 3 years. But these drugs are old drugs at the end of their patent life. So it will curtail the cost of those few drugs that are being price controlled, 10 drugs, 15, 20 drugs a year. But it won't do much at all for the cost of the rest of the drugs on the market. Now, one thing that it does do, which is a plus, is that it constrains the drug company's room to raise their prices to be limited to the cost of living increases. So they can't raise their prices more than inflation. But what it doesn't do, and this is huge, is it doesn't address the initial cost of the drug. And in 2020 and 2021, half of the drugs that came out cost more than $150,000 a year. $150,000 a year. That's like twice, more than twice the median household income of an American family.
So it doesn't change those initial costs. It would allow for Medicare to negotiate drug prices, as you said, on a limited number of drugs. But in general, how impactful could that idea, that practice be on prices?
It's not going to be very impactful. The CBO says that it will cost the drug industry about $30 billion a year, which is a minuscule fraction of their total sales. So what the way we're doing it in the United States is backwards. We are allowing the drug companies to set whatever price they want on the drugs that are approved. And by definition, when a drug's approved, they have a patent on it and they have a monopoly on it, and they can market the drugs very heavily and generate those enormous prices. And then at the end of the drug life, there may be some brief period of negotiation. Other countries do it in the reverse. They evaluate the clinical value of new drugs in the beginning and set the price of the new drugs commensurate with their medical value so that the people in those countries are paying a fair price for the drug throughout the life of the drug, not just at the end of the life of the drug. And the end result of that is that Americans pay 3.5 times more for brand name drugs than people in the other OECD countries.
And if we did allow something like that front-end price control here in America, how would it work? Would it be under the aegis of the FDA or something else?
It wouldn't be the FDA. No, we need another agency. Most of the other wealthy countries have what's called a health technology assessment agency, and that agency is in charge of determining the medical value of a new drug. And then participating in negotiations to set a fair price. The United States is virtually alone amongst wealthy countries in not having health technology assessment. So the truth is that it's only one out of four new drugs that is actually a significant advance over drugs that are already available. But the drug companies can price and market all four drugs. Let's imagine four drugs are approved. The drug company can price and market those drugs as if they're superior. The doctors can't know because we don't have a health technology assessment, because the medical journals that publish the peer-reviewed articles that bring the information of the doctors that they rely upon, the peer reviewers are supposed to vouch for the accuracy of the articles, but the peer reviewers don't even get to see the data. And the guideline writers who set the standards of clinical practice don't get to see the data. So we've got a situation where the drug companies are virtually in charge of setting their own prices and controlling the knowledge about their drugs and through the entire period of the patent of the drugs.
We're talking with Dr. John Abramson of Harvard Medical School about a package from Democrats in the Senate aimed at bringing down prescription drug costs. Dr. Abramson, one of those other measures in that bill that we mentioned was preventing drug companies from raising prices on drugs faster than inflation. Is that something we've been seeing, that it's been outpacing inflation, and has that had a big effect on what we're paying?
For sure, it has, and that could be meaningful, but the more important issue is that the price of new drugs has been going up 20% per year for the last 14 years. So that, as I said before, half of the new drugs that come out cost more than $150,000 a year. So it's that front-end price control that we need. We need to make sure that the front, on the front end, Americans are charged a fair price for the value of the drug, and not just letting the drug companies charge whatever they want.
Another part of this bill, a stated goal would cap prescription costs for those receiving Medicare at $2,000 a year. What? How would it go about doing that?
Well, it's unclear, and I don't think that's been determined. My guess is that what they're going to do is beneficial for Medicare recipients because their out-of-pocket costs will be only $2,000. But who's going to pick up the tab? And my hunch is that there will be government subsidies that pay for the rest of what would have been the out-of-pocket costs. And this is a way to create a safety valve for Medicare recipients, which is a good thing because $2,000 is a lot of money and a lot of people are spending a lot more than that. So that's a good thing. But what we're doing is protecting high drug costs so that the seniors who are unable to afford their medicines don't create a political movement to have a more powerful bill to control the price of drugs. So it's a safety valve, but it's a safety valve that protects individuals but leaves this dysfunctional system standing.
In response to this Democratic plan, we have seen some ads run by the pharmaceutical industry in opposition to it. I want to listen to a couple of those ads right now and see what, do a little fact checking on them. The first one here is paid for by a group called Pharma, a lobbying group for the industry, all about the access to different types of medicines and what this plan would do. Here's a listen.
I'm Sue and I have type 1 diabetes. I depend on Medicare to get my medicines. It's not always easy, but I make it work. Now some in Congress want to make things even harder. They want to repeal a protection in Medicare that protects access to my medicines. They call it negotiation, but it really means the government decides what medicines I can get. That would make it harder for people on Medicare to get the medicines we need. Medicare means access. Please don't take that away.
A pharmaceutical lobby ad there against this plan from Democrats. Dr. Abramson, what do you think about kind of the case laid out in that advertisement?
I think it's just plain false. There's nothing about this bill that's going to restrict what medicines people can get. And I doubt that a pharmaceutical company is going to pull its drug off the market because it has to negotiate a fair price at the end of the patent life. I think it's important to remember that pharma represents the pharmaceutical industry. And no matter how much they try to get us to believe otherwise, the primary job of the pharmaceutical industry is to maximize the financial returns to their investors. And their lobbying and their political contributions and their PR campaigns are all designed to maximize those the returns to investors. And a little bit of history, when Medicare Part D was being negotiated back in 2003, Billy Towson was the chairman, the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's the one who put this plan in, who marshaled this plan through that said Medicare could not negotiate prices with the drug companies. It was a huge win for the drug industry. And after that was negotiated, Billy Towson relinquished his chair in the House of Representatives and took a job working as the CEO of Pharma, the very organization that paid for that ad, at a $2 million a year salary. So this is business. This is hardball business. And they're going to hit the public. And listeners, please, please heed this. They're going to try to hit you with any message that will make you fear that the quality of your medicine, the quality of your healthcare is going to go down. If there were a plan like we were talking about before, where on the front end, fair prices were established, not the back end like this proposal, but if on the front end, fair prices were established, that would be an enormous motivation for the drug companies to make more effective medicines. because they're not going to get paid for the less effective medicines. And I think the quality of our healthcare and the information and options that doctors have to treat their patients would go up enormously if we priced drugs on the front end according to how much they're going to contribute to people's health.
We're talking with Dr. John Abramson right now, lecturer with the Harvard Medical School and author of the book, Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. He's with us today to talk about a plan in Congress that would let Medicare negotiate prescription drug costs, among other things. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Are prescription medicines too expensive for you? How does it affect your monthly budget? Have you had to make choices about what you can afford to take and what you can't afford to take? Do you think it's time drug companies face some new regulations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about prescription drug prices and Democratic legislation in the Senate to bring those prices down. Dr. John Abramson with the Harvard Medical School stays with us. Taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. What has your experience been like paying for prescription drugs? What changes do you want to see in how we price them, how we interact with drug companies? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Abramson, I want to listen to one more ad that people may have seen online, on television, from a pharmaceutical lobbying group opposing this plan. This one talking about the issue of innovation.
Government price setting could mean fewer medicines in the coming years. Which new medicines could be lost? Today, there are 90 medicines in development for Alzheimer's disease, 26 for childhood diabetes, 119 for breast cancer. The list goes on. Which diseases could go untreated if Congress passes government price setting?
I think that's an argument we've heard before, that drug companies will be less incentivized to develop new drugs. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a gross exaggeration, and I think it's an immoral scare tactic. The CNN just reported today that the structure of the bill that's currently being negotiated would lead to 15 fewer drugs being developed over 30 years. And given that one out of four new drugs is actually a significant improvement over previously available therapy, we're talking about missing out on four new drugs over a 30-year period. That doesn't mean that there won't be Alzheimer's drugs and cancer drugs and the kinds of things that we all worry about and we all have family members who are suffering from. But the evidence that there will be fewer drugs is just grossly overstated. And if the drug companies would get paid according to how beneficial their drugs really are, not how beneficial they claim they are, with, I think, the same degree of honesty as these ads have, if they got paid for the real benefit of new drugs, that would mean that we got far more effective new drugs. And that's where we ought to be focusing our attention. I'm not saying this is kind of like the drug bill that just got passed. I think we got to pass it. It's the best thing can get done. It's the political reality. It's got some benefits, and it's better to pass the bill than not pass the bill. But I am saying that we ought not to think that we're solving the cost of prescription drugs for American people and the quality of the information that doctors have about prescription drugs with this bill. It does nothing to help that problem.
And Dr. Abramson, how are drug companies spending their money right now? How much of it goes toward new drug development and how much of it goes towards things, I don't know, like marketing?
Marketing and stock buybacks. So the original bill that was passed, H.R. 3, the Elijah Cummings drug bill that was passed by the House in 2019, called for negotiating on 2.5 times more drugs than this watered down version of it. And the CBO calculated that that would cost the drug industry $450 billion over 10 years. Sounds like a lot of money. And the drug industry went to the PR people and put out ads that it was would be a nuclear winter in innovation. So that's $450 billion over 10 years. It turns out that in the 5 years between 2016 and 2020, the drug industry spent not $450 billion, but $577 billion in stock buybacks and dividends. So they've got more than four times the amount of money that this bill will cost them. They've got to pay for stock buybacks and dividends and claim and tell the untruth to the American people that this is going to cost Americans the benefit of drug innovation, when what they're doing is hoarding their money to raise the returns to their investors.
I want to go to our phones now. We have Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello to you. And I'm so happy that you have this speaker on today. I am 90 years old. I have been told by my endocrinologist that I need to have an IV solution of a drug called Reclast put into my arm because I have advanced osteoporosis, and this drug will keep my bones from further deterioration. And I am very angry about this. This is going to cost me at least $1,000. The amount of the dose is based on the condition of your bones, which needs to be ascertained by having a bone density test. But this is... The speaker is so marvelous to point out to all of us that pharmacology companies own us body and soul, and I am very angry about this.
Nancy, I'm sorry to hear that, and thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. Dr. Abramson, what do you think about what Nancy had to say?
I say, go, girl. That's great. You got the energy. It can be a tough decision about the osteoporosis drugs. They're certainly not cure-alls. They can decrease the risk of fracture somewhat. They tend to decrease spinal fractures more than hip fractures. And the spinal fractures can be painful, but they're not as serious. But what the pharmaceutical companies not only have the patients and the lock on what the patients have to pay for their drugs, but the at least as important is they have the lock on what doctors believe they know to be the science about these drugs. They control that science. You can't get the data. It's like the data for the vaccines. You can't get the data if you're not in litigation. I've spent 10 years in litigation. I know what's in the data. I don't know about Reclast, but I know what's in the data, at least for some drugs, and it's not what doctors think it is. And that's a problem that's lurking behind all of this, is the quality of the knowledge that doctors have about the best way to take care of their patients. And now pharma virtually controls that knowledge.
Dr. Abramson, you've talked about the importance of doing what other countries do and setting those drug prices on the front end rather than negotiating. We just have a minute left, but what would it take to sort of get momentum behind that movement going here in America?
Well, we're in a near state of political paralysis, so we're far from it. But what it would take is Americans care about this. 90% of Americans think the way Nancy does. Americans care. They know they're not getting treated right by the pharmaceutical industry. The doctors are a little bit slower to be critical about what's going on, but the doctors can't bring the service to their patients the way they believe they can, because the information is so controlled by the commercial drug companies. And finally, the business owners who aren't making money on healthcare are getting ripped off, and the profitability of their corporations is getting compromised by the money that we waste on healthcare. So a coalition of 80 or 90% of Americans, of healthcare professionals and of business owners could take this on, but it would have to be a coalition that transcended political parties and was laser focused on the quality of the information that doctors get about the drugs that they prescribe, and a rebalancing of our healthcare system to be focused on the best way to help Americans be healthy rather than to make the most money on drugs.
A big thanks to our guest, Dr. John Abramson from Harvard Medical School, talking with us today about a Democratic plan in the Senate to lower prescription drug costs. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, we'll take a closer look at the first pictures from the James Webb Space Telescope. That's tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. I spent some time in Appleton last weekend, checked out the History Museum there and the planetarium down the road in Menasha. Something else I saw was a lot of sidewalk chalk. People in the downtown area were laying down some seriously amazing chalk art, far beyond anything I've accomplished in my chalk days. It turns out there's a lot of chalk art festivals coming up around the state. This Saturday in Eau Claire, you can catch the 2022 Chalk Fest on the UW campus there. And Kenosha is hosting a chalk festival this weekend, too. On August 13th, you'll have events in Green Bay and in Oshkosh on Opera House Square. August 20th, the Art and Chalk Fest in West Bend. And finally, on August 27th, Platteville is hosting the Chalk and Cheese Festival. Platteville, you've got me convinced. I think I'm going to be heading your way. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.